Fühlst du dich beim Yoga-Unterrichten manchmal unsicher, obwohl du eigentlich alles richtig machst? Dann ist mein neuer Wochenend-Workshop von Unsicherheit zu innerer Überzeugung diesen November in Berlin genau das Richtige für dich. Wir gehen dorthin, wo herkömmliche Weiterbildungen aufhören. Wir lösen die tiefer liegenden Blockaden, die dich klein halten. Für mehr Vertrauen, mehr Leichtigkeit und ein Unterrichten, das sich endlich wie du selbst anfühlt. Finde mehr Informationen auf peaceyoga.de oder schreib mir einfach direkt. Und jetzt viel Spaß bei der nächsten Podcast-Folge.
To me, that's a sure recipe for unhappiness and for never feeling like you have enough time. Because you never are, like you said, you never get to complete or really feel present
right
in what you're doing.
Welcome to a new episode of my podcast, and it is a premiere for multiple reasons. It's the first episode in English, and it's the first episode with a real in-person guest sitting in my living room, literally. So we're going to have a living room chat, and I was thinking about the title of my podcast in English, so let me try to translate. I think it would be, is that still yoga? Question mark. And then about the searching and finding of enlightenment. I think that could be a good translation for the title I chose. And it's also a very special episode because I have here with me my dear teacher, Sharon Padma Gannon, who also is the founder of Jiva Mukti Yoga. And we will dive into many different topics. It is rather unscripted how I do all my podcasts because we just want to go with the flow, as they say. And we also just chanted a little mantra just to be sure we're connected to the divine source, and let's see what comes out of us. So welcome, Sharon. Thank you for being here and taking the time for that little dialogue and chat that we're going to have.
Do you really think that we take time?
Oh, that is already a good question to start with.
I get to ask you questions as well.
Yes, exactly. Thank you. Yeah, I remember you were talking about that the other day. And it really, stuck with me that instead of taking time, could we receive time? And although we actually have a timer right here next to us, which is not counting down, it is counting up, which kind of is good because it's infinite. It's never ending. And taking time is very restrictive in a way. And confining.
Yeah, and it kind of speaks to our human habit of grabbing and taking and hoarding and consuming, which causes us to be very concerned about I and mine. Those kinds of concerns are not very conducive to yoga. And it's a good thing, I think, to look deeper into the words that we use and the phrasing and question if that's really what we mean to say. And I think I agree with you. Could we receive time rather than take it? Or meaning, could we be more accepting of the privilege that we have in this incarnation and the time that we have while we are alive? I think it's a better way of thinking of it. Taking time can make you feel like you don't have enough time and that it would cause you to be in a hurry. And being in a hurry, you're not relaxed, and it's very difficult to drop into the present moment then. And that is what yoga really encourages us. And that is really what yoga practice really encourages us to do.
Right.
To be present in the now.
And it's much more fun, I guess, too, right? Because otherwise, as you said, you always feel you're running out of time, or you do not have enough time to do this or that. And maybe I've been there, and maybe some people listening have been there. They're always feeling that they can't get things done, or they always have to say, "Oh, I don't have enough time. I'm doing so many things at once," or "I can't even do my yoga practice because I don't have time. I can't fit it into my schedule. It's a 90-minute class. I have to go to the yoga school. I can't do any of those things." And then maybe we even stop the yoga practice at all, and we just feel it doesn't fit into our lives because we have so much work to do, etc. What do you think about that? If you feel like you don't have time for yoga practice?
Well, let's think about what is yoga. I mean, if we're practicing yoga, that means we're moving towards a goal. And what do you think yoga means? What is your definition of yoga?
So I really like to go back to the original meaning of the word union. And then, of course, the question that comes up, union of what? Like, what is coming together? What is being connected? And I mean, I really kind of go with the idea of the greater and the smaller self coming together. That's something that resonates with me, and that is easy for me to kind of grasp. Although the question comes up, what is that greater self? And what is the smaller self? And what does it entail? So, as always, asking questions, I think, is an important thing to be done. Because then we can answer the question, is yoga really only happening when I go into a school and when I roll out my mat? Or could there be other opportunities for me to practice on that reminder that my small temporary self can reconnect or remember its source, the greater self?
Work, when you mentioned a moment ago, don't have time for my yoga practice because I have to go to work, as if work was something that you don't really want to do. It's not fun. And yoga is just a kind of an optional thing in your life that if you have time, you'll pursue that, but it's not really a priority. Your work is your priority. Why is that? You know, it's money, I think. People put money, the making of money, above yoga, which is really, I mean, the yogic teachings tell us it's the most important thing in life. And no matter how long we live, it will be short. And that is the most important pursuit, is yoga, to remember, as you so nicely said, to join the small with the large, to remember who you really are, which is much more than just that small self. You are connected and part of that bigger self. And of course, there are many ways to refer to that bigger self. God is one. And yoga does mean that union with God or the higher self, the Atman, the eternal soul. And, you know, as we ask these questions, which is very much a part of yoga practice, Swadhyaya, asking these types of questions and going deeper and deeper to the place where we really surrender and realize there are no answers, permanent answers. There's always something to delve deeper into. And that can be fun, to be in a place where you don't know. To suspend that cognitive, intellectual
Urge, or
faculty, that urge to know something package it and put it away mm-hmm. and on to the next thing. And anyone who has actually seriously pursued analytical, intellectual knowledge, they come to realize that it's endless. There's you can always find something new.
Right.
I mean, every scientist of any subject has come to that eventually.
Yes. And sometimes you think you know, but then you always will find someone who knows better or has a different approach, different opinion on things. And it's the whole idea or obstacle, I think, of compartmentalizing in general. May it be into the boxes of this is right and this is wrong, because this is where it leads to, right? That idea of I want to do the right thing. I want to do the right yoga practice, or I want to do the right asana sequence. I want to do the correct meditation or the correct pronunciation of a Sanskrit word. And then once I found that, I think maybe I will be enlightened. But then just to realize it's not happening, from my experience at least. And then, as you said, another thing opens up. And then the compartmentalizing of work and private life, or this is my yoga life and this is my other life and this is my holiday and this is when I'm on business. And that really causes a lot of stress even, because you're kind of ping-ponging between the two all the time.
You're fragmenting yourself and you're denying what your sense of enjoyment is moving you towards. No, I have to work because that's important, because I have to pay the rent, or I have to put my kids through college, or I have to save money for whatever it is you're wanting to purchase next. And it's like, it's not... Like, work is the serious part of life, the important part of life to many people. And the other pursuits are secondary. And even people will give their whole life to being unhappy. And work has this connotation. It's not something I like, but it's something I have to do. And when I earn enough money, or when I get more stable, then I can do the things I really like. I mean, that's a common way of approaching life. And so, as you said, we compartmentalize. And I think that causes us to be fragmented beings who are not whole. And the idea of holiness will forever elude us, from our own doing, because we compartmentalize of the activities or the roles that we feel we have to play, and we put them in a hierarchy, those roles. And what if we threw that all away? It would take a lot of courage, tremendous amount of courage, I think, in our society today, but to actually find joy in everything that we do, whether it's going to work or going to the yoga class or practicing yoga at your home. Wow, what a concept. By yourself in your room, eating a meal, taking vitamins or supplements. You know, so many people, it's like, oh, I hate the taste of this. Oh, this is horrible, but I guess I have to do it to be healthy. I really think that that is dangerous thinking. I mean, I have found that to be dangerous thinking. I don't want to eat anything that I don't feel good about, that doesn't make me happy.
Right.
Even if someone tells me, oh, it's a healthy thing to eat, or you should be eating that, I question that. Maybe for them, okay, fine. Who am I to say what someone else should do? But it is my job to figure out what I should do.
Of course. And I think what you just said reminds me that one of my first episodes had the title, I think, kind of like how, you know, washing the dishes can be a yoga practice. And it was all about the intention and why we're doing it. Can you maybe give us an example of how you do that? How eating a meal, how, you know, doing things you don't really enjoy doing maybe in general, but how we can turn that around and make it a yoga practice and make it an offering?
Well, I have discovered that something that has helped me is routine. Now, for some people who aren't really into time management in that way, might think that doing something every day in like the same way or a similar way at the same time might take too much time. But actually, I have discovered it gives you a lot more time. Like, for me, the first thing I do is my meditation practice in the morning. I mean, just sit up and do it. And, you know, some people might say, well, that's great for you, but I don't have time to do that. Okay. Do as you like. But for me, it gives me time. And to do the Krishna Seva that I do, which is a yogic practice of deity worship. But each part of that practice takes organization. Like, I have to present the flowers. I have to fill the water pitcher for the deity. I have to bathe the deity. I have to get out the clothes, et cetera, et cetera. So I approach washing the dishes in the same way, that I'm organizing my kitchen. I'm clearing the mess. I'm clearing the atmosphere by organizing and knowing that first I'll wash the silverware, then I'll wash the glasses, you know, like do it like that. Organization, keep making my bed. Like, I really always have time to make my bed, no matter how many things I have to do. And because I've just surrendered to that, I have a lot of time to do a lot of things compared to other people who tell me that they couldn't do all of those things. Routine, I think, is the key. And approaching routine with joy and fun. It's a fun thing to do, to put things in place. I can't really explain it better than that. Putting things in place, organizing, sorting things, not having just a whole mumble-jumble mess. You know, they say that prosperity comes from the goddess Lakshmi. She is beauty, harmony, wealth, prosperity. And I have a very good friend in the form of Hari Mulakutla. He's also your friend and a friend to many in the Jyomuti community. And he has been a business consultant for many years. And he has his own business. And his clients are very high up, mover and shaker type of people. And so when he's called in to help a business or a government, because governments run as businesses. The first thing he does is look at the CEO's office or the president's office or how their desk is organized. And if it's all disorganized and messy, that's the first step in remedying the problem. Because if you, as the head of the organization, cannot keep your desk clean and in place and know where the things that you need are, and your house is the same way, prosperity will always elude you.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, each one of us is the CEO of our own lives.
Yes.
And the president or the, you know,
yeah,
we're in charge.
Yeah, we have all those roles, basically,
yeah,
all in one. And yeah, that's really interesting on many levels, I think. Kind of projecting what happens in a small space, kind of the microcosm we are in, and how that will affect the rest, the macrocosm, you know, even just our apartment affecting the rest of our lives, or a tiny little thing. And what you said, putting things in order and also doing one thing at a time, it seems.
Yes.
Because most of the times, and I know that feeling, is I have many things on my to-do list, and instead of starting with one, I'm kind of getting caught up in, oh, there are so many things I need to do. So I spend more time on thinking, what is the next thing I'm going to do, instead of just doing one, you know, just starting with one, which sometimes it's a lot faster than we think it is, right? It might just take 5 minutes, but it feels like it's going to take 7 hours.
Yes. What about when you're washing the dishes or doing a task,
right,
that you already have projected onto that task,
mm-hmm,
that it's not going to be fun, that it's a chore. And so you put on earphones or headphones, right? So you're doing another thing that you feel is more fun, so it can, mm-hmm, you can get through that uncomfortable thing.
Right.
To me, that's a sure recipe for unhappiness and for never feeling like you have enough time, because you never are, like you said, you never get to complete or really, mm-hmm, feel present,
right,
in what you're doing. And the other day you brought up something very interesting to me that I think relates to what we're talking about. We were in the yoga workshop, and I was teaching Surya Namaskar, mm-hmm, and getting people to count the breaths and to spend equal time on each part of the sequence, whether it was, you know, something that was they felt was difficult or something easy, like Tadasana. Mm-hmm. Most people think Tadasana is easy.
Right.
And Chaturanga Dandasana is not so easy. But to give each of those asanas equal time, the four counts. And can you just relay like your insight about that?
Yes.
Because I thought it was very interesting. And I agree, totally. I have come to the same thing.
Yes, because I think we're also talking about that feeling of time and how some things feel fast, some things feel slow. And that sometimes when I teach vinyasa, like we do in our method, and I give the rhythm, 1, 2, 3, 4, 1, 2, 3, 4, and people get afraid that it is so fast, like I'm counting so fast. But by the time they get to lowering down into Chaturanga, they feel, oh my God, it's very slow. Because it's something, as you said, like they don't like that. And then at another movement where they feel it's actually easy, they feel, oh, it's too fast. So the same amount of time can have a very different experience. It could feel slow, it could feel fast. So then time all of a sudden is very relative, and that experience of time is relative. And I think that is also what makes that vinyasa practice so valuable and so much deeper than just breathing and moving and have a little bit of music playing.
Or getting
on the
warmed
side.
Up and
yes.
Sweaty.
Yes, yes. Like it gives you a deeper understanding to go beyond time, maybe even. And I know you and David are often relating that vinyasa practice to the Yoga Sutra, where Patanjali talks about that idea that only at the very end, like when we look back on time or a progress of a sequence of things, we will be able to understand how these things are really working out and how elements of time are connected.
The kshana krama.
Yes.
Each moment, each kshana.
Yes.
right, in the karma.
Right. And maybe that's a good segue also into the idea of asana in general, because what you just said, being precise and, you know, having structure, I think that is something we can practice in the asana practice on the mat, to be precise, to, because alignment, for example, to me, it is not something that is just about doing it in a healthy way. And yes, we don't want to injure ourselves, of course, but practicing alignment as a practice to be precise and to focus and be in the present moment and doing one thing at a time. Like, I'm placing my foot right now in a certain way. I'm not thinking of the next asana. I'm not even thinking of the last. And doing that consciously. How do you feel asana? Like, what does asana mean to you? Like, what does it entail? And I know it's much more than getting stronger and being flexible, but I would like to hear it from you.
Well, I think there's only one asana. And that is your connection to reality. And to equate it to your relationship with time, I think is very, very helpful for a deeper insight and understanding about what is it, what is the value in the practice of asana to us who are on this path, the yogic path, the spiritual path, wanting to remember who we really are, wanting to remember our connection to the higher self, to God. And there's only one asana, I feel, and that's our relationship with reality. And if you delve into that, then lots of questions come up. What is reality?
Right. What is real?
What is real? What is real? And can we really know that? Can we really know what is real? Can we really live real lives? Can we comprehend fully anything?
And is our limited intellect even able to do that? Which brings us back to what we talked about before. Like, we would like to, like, know it. We would like to understand it, like we understand how to build a house or make a meal. Can we really understand that idea of the vast ocean of limitless potential that is how reality is sometimes described with many different words? Because in the end, probably words cannot really describe it. It's just kind of trying to get closer to that idea.
But you just said, can we really comprehend it with our limited intellect?
Yes.
So you answered your question. The intellect is limited.
Right.
So we cannot comprehend it with just the intellect. But we can experience and feel beyond the intellect, beyond putting it into words. I mean, words are fun. Come on.
Yes,
right?
They are.
They're fun. They give us something to play with. Ideas are fun. And I think they become more fun if we give them space. And if we actually use them with affection.
Right.
And not try to pressure them so much to tell us everything there is to know. But we play around with definitions. And what you just said, like, we can know how to build a house. Well, when you said that, I was thinking, well, but how to build a house actually keeps changing.
Yes.
For designers, for architects, for builders.
And over time.
And over
so
time.
Different.
I mean, how to build a house, like, 10,000 years ago and how to build a house in 2025.
Yes. Very different.
Very different.
The definition of a house.
The definition of a house.
Yes.
And to me, that's so exciting, you know? It's not a freak out. It's not like, oh no, I'll never be able to understand anything. I mean, to be able to be in a place of not knowing is like what you were saying. You step into this infinite potential. And I like that.
Yes.
And it might seem to some that that's contradictory to living a life and embracing routine and organization. But actually, I think it's key.
Because through that, you can only, that's how you can experience the other idea. And it's like Patanjali saying, only if you understand the moments in time, like the separate minutia. Elements, like being very precise and, you know, going into time deeply, then only can you transcend it and go beyond that. What you just said about words reminded me also, because the question that came up to me when you said there's only one asana, I was like, okay, great, but then why are we doing all of this? Like, why did you invent different asana sequences, etc.? But the asanas could be like words too, and we can play around with them and explore them and put them together in different orders, just the way you explained so nicely how we can do it with words in our language.
Wow. You are a person after my own heart. I have also always felt that the asanas were like an alphabet. And the way that you sequence them is like composing a poem.
Right.
Or a mathematical formula. And so each sequence brings about a specific experience. Because we're dealing with the chakras. We're dealing with the doorways to perception, the levels of perception. We're dealing with karmic relationships, standing asanas, seated asanas, twists, back bends, inversions like Svarangasana, handstand, headstand, where you're totally upside down and the head is down, the feet are up. These specific asanas give us the opportunity to access these chakras where there are stored karmas, and those karmas are in relation to others, also to ourselves, how we relate to ourselves, how we relate to God, how we relate to the world, and it's like I lost my train of thought.
You were talking about the different relationships, how the asanas bring about the practice with the different relationships to the world, other people, to God. Might come back.
It will come back. But it was a good one.
That's how it works sometimes. I think the good ones.
I got it. I got it.
Great,
I got it.
We're
it
back.
Came. It came. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Asana. Why we like to use that word instead of pose or posture. Because asana means a relationship. And a relationship is dynamic. It moves. It changes. And whereas the word pose implies something static.
Right, like you're holding.
Holding.
It, yeah.
And posture even like that.
Yeah.
Something that has, that is restricted and has no room to move. And this goes back to what you said about alignment and the precision. But it must be dynamic. When a relationship is dynamic, when an asana is dynamic, then you have an opportunity to explore. Mm-hmm. You have an opportunity to go with your sense of adventure, not knowing where you're going necessarily. And with that openness of heart and mind and body, you could learn new things. Curiosity can take you into unknown territory. So that's exciting.
Yes, it is. And I think the dynamic idea of, you know, having a dynamic relationship also in relationships with other people, if you want to hold it and kind of have it fixated in a specific way, it usually doesn't work out very well. I mean, for a short amount of time, but then, you know, both sides have to adapt and be able to be flexible, literally, in order to keep the balance alive. It's like when you stand on one foot and you want to keep the foot flat on the floor, then you usually fall down. Like, if you want to hold onto the balance, it's not going to work out. You have to have the foot, the asana, the connection to the earth, be adaptable to what is happening there. I have one last idea and question and thought I would like to discuss with you. And we brought it up earlier, but I didn't want to go there just yet, which is God.
God.
And you mentioned it before that yoga is a, you know, remembrance of God, or the offering. You mentioned your practice, the seva, which is an offering, a service to God. And I know from my experience working with other yoga teachers and yoga students that that word is still very triggering in many different ways. Either people say, oh, I'm not religious, I can't really deal with that word, or I am religious and I have a very specific idea of what God is, so it can be part of my yoga practice. What would you say could help maybe transcend all of these problems? And what is your idea of God?
You know, what other people, their opinions, I respect them. And I respect that they might not understand my perspective. Mm-hmm. And I don't want to try to convert anyone. I think all opinions are valid when it comes to God. Because it is a very personal thing, our relationship with God. And so really, I'm not, to convert others to my way of thinking, it's just not fun. Mm-hmm. It sounds tedious. It sounds like, like that. So I don't really know if it would help anyone to even express in this podcast.
Yes,
my thoughts. I hope everyone just finds a way that makes them happy.
That's our job as yoga teachers, I guess, to provide different tools. Maybe because you have Krishna as a word and as an idea for God. And I heard you often, you know, interpret and explain what Krishna means as your innermost heart's desire.
Yeah.
And I think that is something that most everyone can relate to. So maybe you can give us some inspiration of what that means to you.
Thank you. Well, you just said it. You explained it so nicely. The word itself, once again, we're back to words and the magic of words. Magic meaning that the study of words, the delving into words, can shift our perception of even what we thought the words meant a minute ago. Krishna means the all-attractive, or you could define it as your innermost heart's desire, that which is the most what is attracting you more than anything else.
It's kind of like a magnet. You want to go there. You want to hear about it, talk about it, feel it all day long.
Like we have many desires and we experience the need to fulfill desires every day of our life. I mean, we wake up, we have a desire. We want to go to the bathroom, or we want to have a cup of coffee, or we want to do our japa, or we, I mean, there's so many desires propel us through the day. You cannot live your life without desire. You know, and a lot of people think, oh, the yogis don't have any desires.
Getting rid of desires.
Yeah. No desires. Well, actually, no. I mean, none of the scriptures say that. It's about realizing what the innermost desire underneath all of those desires is. Mm-hmm. If you keep probing deeper, and that's what we've been talking about, going down the rabbit hole and not being content with just a superficial definition of something. And so if you keep probing and probing, you will find your innermost heart's desire. And the name for that, the descriptive name for that is Krishna, that which is all attractive, that is your innermost heart's desire. Now, each individual person can define in their own way what that might mean. But simply put, Krishna is non-denominational, if you look at it that way. It's too deep and intrinsic and primal to be contained in any religious system or spiritual system. Mm-hmm. It's beyond that. Because each one of us, if we are courageous enough to recognize, we have an innermost heart's desire.
Yes.
And that is what the practice of yoga is about, pursuing that, moving towards that, allowing that to fill every moment, every kshana of the day, every activity. And that's what Krishna says in the Bhagavad Gita. Do what you do, whatever it is, going to work, doing Surya Namaskar, practicing yoga, sleeping, whatever it is. But remember me when you're doing it. Remember your innermost heart's desire. And then your life will be happy.
Yes, it sounds really good.
It is good.
Something I can just encourage everyone to try. And I think...
you know what?
Oh, we're not trying.
Don't even
we're doing
go
it.
There. What other people do, Moritz, we really have no control. Even as teachers, we can give advice if we're asked. But ultimately, people will do what they do. And we have to be okay with that. Because to tell people what they should do is minding their business.
Not ours.
And then who's minding our business, right?
Right.
Our job is to mind our own business.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So we're just sharing things. And everyone who listens or watches, it's up to you to take whatever you can take from this. And something we're not going to go into, but I really wanted to share, because a lot of these ideas you just mentioned, also that the idea of God being everywhere and in everyone and in everything, because I think also what the yoga practices could do is that our senses ultimately could see God in everything and hear God in everything, is really the idea of a great person of our history, one of the five acharyas. And most of you listening probably have heard about Shankaracharya, which is well known. You said it the other day, because his work has been translated into almost every language and then gained a lot of popularity over time. And the kind of the latest of those five acharyas is Vallabhacharya. And he, just to sum it up, said, okay, good, I agree with a lot of things that have been said, But I also think God isn't something out there, and Brahman isn't just there, and then we're the bad people. Our temporary mind is kind of useless, and we have to get over it and get rid of it. But really, even in the temporary, we can find Brahman, and we can find God, and we can find the real thing, and we can find reality. So that's something I would like to share on here too, and I know you do many times, or you did many times, and you keep on mentioning it. And sometimes these things that are unknown to a lot of people doesn't mean that they're less valuable, just because they're not as shiny. Maybe they're not the shiny objects.
They haven't had easily. Big marketing teams behind them. I think more, that's more close to the truth.
Yes. So we are a part of that little marketing team now for some new ideas to think about and, you know, ponder and reflect upon. And I think to sum up our conversation here is really to keep asking questions.
Keep asking questions.
With an open mind, you might not find an answer. And that is the fun of it. And that can be the joy of asking questions.
I think if you do find an answer, question that answer.
Yes. And if you find the ultimate answer, share it with us and let us know.
Well, in the Rig Veda, which is considered to be one of the oldest scriptures, there is a line. I don't know it in Sanskrit, but it says something like, who knows this? No one knows.
Yes. And that's all we need, actually, right? That line says
No one knows. But you see, when I heard that, I thought, that must be a riddle. That must be a code. And I took it to mean, no one knows. But maybe together we can know. We can know together. And we live at a time, the Kali Yuga, where satsang is said to be the most important sadhana. And that is a coming together and sharing ideas and talking about things, discussing elevated subjects, as your podcast is committed to doing.
Yes, and just like we did
in
the last minutes. And also, I encourage everyone in every episode to, you know, reach out, write me, text me. I'm always happy to hear your thoughts, or maybe also topics you want me to discuss or guests you want me to talk to, because that really, as you said, the conversation and communication, like getting together, and the idea of satsang these days, yes, can happen in person, and it is great to be in the physical presence, but nowadays can also be transferred into the digital world and gives us so many opportunities to connect with like-minded people and people that hopefully inspire us. Thank you, Sharon. You definitely keep on inspiring me and many others. So thank you for, I don't want to say taking the time. Thank you for
spending time. Immersing ourselves in the time.
Yes, for allowing me to receive time with you. And
precious time.
Yes,
very time precious. Time is precious.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. Blessings to you. Shri Krishna Sharanam Mama.
Shri Krishna Sharanam Mama.
Shri Krishna Sharanam Mama. Hari Om.
Hari Om. Thank you.